Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Oh, my God, you're so smart. Yeah. I was totally going to go on eBay, but every time you try to search for a radio block,
it'll be all synced up and like Atomic and everything. Seriously. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, where we are getting smart in the actual process of starting the show. And also, every week, we dive deep into all things tech, the economy, and culture. Of course, we couldn't do it without you, because none of us is as smart as all of us, especially the guy who pointed out that the economy, tech, and culture equals et cetera.
Et cetera, which was really kind of brilliant.
I still love that.
I know, right? We are still not actually here doing the show. We're on a holiday break. We did these early. But we do have you covered with some Make Me Smart greatest hits from the year that was.
This week, a good one. A Make Me Smart interview was Kai only, and it touched on some of the big issues of free speech and the internet. I got to be a spectator on this interview, and I loved it.
So I talked to Kate Klonick. She's a law professor at St. John's Law College. We recorded this, by the way, back in August, around the time that Alex Jones of InfoWars was getting kicked off a whole lot of digital platforms, Facebook, Apple, YouTube. Twitter was, at that point, the only platform that still had Jones on their site. But after this interview ran, Twitter got rid of Alex Jones as well, saying his accounts violated rules against inciting violence.
Yeah, and in the ensuing weeks and months, in fact, this idea of deplatforming, this sort of removal or reducing the visibility of controversial figures, has become much more common. These platforms, Twitter in particular, actually has gotten a lot more aggressive. It's very interesting. There are some signs that this method works, that kicking bad actors off these big platforms may in fact diminish their reach and their ability to organize. Tim Cook got a Courage Against Hate Award from the Anti-Defamation League. However, you know, it's all been up and down. The social media platform Gab, known for hosting a lot of hate speech and racism, is back, even after its web hosting company, GoDaddy, shut it down. And frankly, there's a lot of conversation about to what extent this might constitute censorship in some form.
Oh, man, I didn't know if you were going to go there with the censorship thing, because that's you
bet
and I don't
am.
Necessarily agree on that whole First Amendment. Anyway, clearly, as you can tell by that little byplay right there, we are not done with this whole topic of digital platforms and free speech. There will be more, I guarantee, gosh darn to you, in 2019 about this. So we're going to be watching for stuff like videos and doctored videos. What happens with Facebook? Oh, my goodness, are we still trying to figure out what they're doing? And to Molly's point, censorship, government oversight, regulation, all of that stuff. So anyway, Kate Klonick, some of the big ideas about all of these things from a conversation we had back in August. Here you go. Kate, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Let me do one thing, first of all, and I'm not sure when you did constitutional law in law school. It's probably like a first-year thing, right?
Yep.
Yeah, one would hope. This is not a First Amendment deal, right? Facebook and all of those taken down, Alex Jones does not give him a First Amendment claim.
No, not at all. First Amendment claims only arise if it's the government that's stopping someone from talking or someone from speaking about something. But Apple, Facebook, all of these platforms, they're private entities, and they can decide who speaks on their platforms and who doesn't.
Okay, so Facebook and all the rest of them, they can do this whatever they want, right?
Yeah, and actually, I think that, you know, to get to your question of why this is happening now, this has been actually happening for a long time. It's been happening for at least since 2005, really kind of in earnest at Facebook since 2008, 2009, in which they were really kind of decided to start moderating user-generated content and the content that was posted on their sites. But it's suddenly kind of catching, you know, the public's consciousness that this is something that these platforms are doing.
Okay, so let me ask you about the platform that has decided Alex Jones and his hate speech is not violating any of its rules. Because let's be clear here, what Facebook and YouTube and all the rest of them said was, this is a violation of our terms of service, in essence, and we're going to take it down. Twitter and Jack Dorsey, the CEO, has said, we can't find a rules violation, so we're going to let him stay up. Discuss.
Yeah, well, I mean, they make the rules, right? So those rules can change whenever they want them to. And so if they decide someday that Alex Jones does violate the rules, they don't have to be inconsistent with their previous statement. Hmm. They get to make whatever it is the standard is going to be for what constitutes hate speech. And so that's kind of a really interesting question, which is kind of how it is that these platforms are setting those rules, what they think that they're reflecting. You know, if they're reflecting the norms of their users, a really great question to ask is which users? The users in the U.S., the users globally, the users in Europe? It gets to be a really hard question.
So to that end, actually, and reflecting the views of its users, here comes what is going to come across as a really I guess somewhat despicable question, but here goes. Is it possible that somewhere in Twitter's internal deliberations, they said, look, we need people to come to our site. We need people to use Twitter. And even though it's hateful, and even though what he says is vile and horrible and ruins people's lives, there is a business case advantage to keep him here so that the people who want to hear Alex Jones can come here.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely part of the metric that I think that they're balancing. But I would say that people probably are overstating how much money or how much engagement something like Alex Jones brings in for something like Twitter from just a very monetary mm-hmm. standpoint. Mm-hmm. For instance, you know, they might get just as much backlash of people quitting the platform for not taking him down. Yeah. And so, it's hard to decide, like, where you're going to draw that line. But yeah, of course, I think that that's a decision that they're making. I think that the bigger decision it seems like Twitter is making is what they want their identity to be and their values to be as a platform. And they've gone back and forth on this a lot in the last 10 years. I mean, they started out as the free speech platform for the Free Speech Party. And they had a very absolute free speech stance. And then they've walked that back a lot in response to harassment and other types of things the last few years. So it's interesting that they're making a stand on this now.
Did you see the piece in the New York Times maybe 3, 4, 5 days ago, a week ago, that the Twitter had let the Times into one of its big, not all hands, but certainly a large meeting about where they discussed all this kind of stuff? And it read to me like they honestly kind of can't make up their minds.
Yeah, I don't think anyone can make up their minds. I think that I loved that piece, and I thought that it was, and this conversation is a great conversation because of this. I don't know if you had to think about how you were going to do any of this or how you're going to make a policy like this and enforce it consistently. I think any of us would have a really hard time doing it. I think judges have a hard time doing it or have had a hard time doing it in First Amendment cases over the years. Mm-hmm. I think that newsrooms have had a really hard time doing this. And now we're kind of seeing these public platforms struggle with it. And I think it's really difficult.
Well, look no farther than Morning Edition the other day, right? I'm assuming a lot of people who listen to this podcast listen to public radio writ large and Morning Edition and having the guy who staged the Unite the Right rally on, right? And where is the balance there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, on the one hand, you don't want it to, I mean, the comparison that's always used is you don't want to give, you know, a platform to Hitler, right? But, I mean, no one knew that Hitler was Hitler before, in the process.
Yeah, and, well, wait, because now we know. Now we know Hitler was Hitler. And these guys are saying some of the things that Hitler said.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, but then you run into a second problem, which is like, do you not publish their speech and let them say it where they want to say it?
Right.
Or do you let them go and find it in the dark corners of the internet? And, you know, is it better that we can keep an eye on all of it at least and kind of have a nice sense that it's out there? You know, that's one of the problems you have with kicking terrorists and extremists off these major platforms. But they have, I think that now they're kind of realizing that taking down some of this stuff really does make it a lot more difficult for these ideas to spread. And so I think that's one of the main empirical reasons that people are finally kind of getting on the train of taking more of this stuff down.
Yeah. Do you know who Jonah Goldberg is?
Yeah.
Okay. So for those who don't, he's a conservative writer and commentator. He is actually on public radio sometimes. He writes for the National Review, and he does a weekly column, which is usually thoughtful, and this past weekend was spot on. And he was talking about a lot of things, but one of which was this InfoWars thing and viewpoints like that, and the companies that we have talked about so far in this interview taking him down. And here's one of the things he said, and I'll just read it. When it falls to a bunch of giant corporations or the federal government to decide what speech is permissible, it is usually a sign that the rest of civil society has failed to do its job. That's the end of the quote. I think that's kind of spot on.
I think that's spot on, too. I mean, I think that that's one of the things that I write about is that these are not just corporations. This isn't like oil, like this isn't some giant oil corporation or, you know, Kellogg or like something else, right? Or a pharma company. Mm. These are giant transnational companies that basically have democratized speech and access to publication in a way that we've never seen before in all of human history.
Which is a positive, right? That statement right there is a good thing. We want that.
No. Completely. Right. And, you know, and that's exactly right. And they are governing transnationally, like without like with like relative like non-regard to borders. But like they're as strong and as significant as nation states and as governments. And I think that his point is exactly right. It is really time for civil society to step in. It is time for users to step in. It is time for there to be a pushback in the same way that we would push back against a government.
There is kind of like we alluded to before this interview even started, so many things at play here, a lot going on there.
Yeah, totally. And we're not actually even done with the actual discussion that Kate and I had, and also the bigger discussion of what it all means. Anyway, more from Kate Klonick, including what users can do about the whole mess that is information in the society today, right after we pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. The shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
And we're back. Here's more of Kai talking platforms with Kate Klonick.
What do you think that pushback looks like, though? Do we stop using Twitter because they're still having Alex Jones up there?
Well, I think that the reason that these things stay, that the only pressure point for any of these platforms is not really money necessarily, but relevance. I think that they need to stay relevant and they need to become, you need to keep engaging, but not even just keep engaging, they need to be popular. When they don't reflect the policies of the users, that's their soft spot. They have to kind of be doing the things that make people want to keep going on them. So it's not just not using them. It's like a kind of a broader picture of using that pressure point to kind of create a good reputation for their company that makes them, gives them staying power.
Yeah. What do we do with the fact that, without any religious connotation here, in this area, Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO and co-founder and controlling shareholder of Facebook, has basically become God?
Oh, no. I think that is exactly right. I think he's a benevolent dictator.
Yeah.
I think that he is very much a benevolent dictator. I think that he is, there could be a lot worse people in power for those type of things, but that's kind of the other thing I was going to say, that these are not like corporations that we typically think of, oil or whatever else, because they're controlling rights that we have. Like, they're controlling fundamental rights to privacy and expression that typically we don't sign over those types of rights to companies. And so this is kind of why he is especially kind of like a dictator or a governor, because he has created a system of governance.
I wonder if, and certainly, you know, I've said that he just doesn't get it and doesn't understand. And Molly and I have had this conversation repeatedly, both on Marketplace and on this podcast. I wonder if maybe he's a little paralyzed.
Oh, I think that there's a lot going on. I mean, I hear things through the grapevine, but there's, I think that it is a little paralyzing. I think that it's a lot of power for a guy who just wanted to make a Rolodex that worked on the internet. Yeah. You know, it just is so to kind of think what this has become. I don't think any of us, and I mean any of us, meaning like the world, could have foreseen what today's world would look like with Facebook 10 years ago, even Mark Zuckerberg. So, yeah, I think it is probably very daunting. But I think he's very serious about changing it. And that's the benevolent part of the dictatorship. Yeah, I think that he does want to ultimately reflect, do the right thing for the users. But it's unclear if he can do that without pissing everyone off.
Right. Can we talk here for a second, since you are a lawyer, about the law and about what makes these platforms not be liable, I guess, in a way, for the content that is produced?
Yeah, well, at least in the U.S., there's a, in 1997, Congress passed a law called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And that was basically a law that meant that, you know, we hold things like the New York Times liable for defamation that they publish on their web pages. You can sue them for defamation. And it's one of the ways that we use as a check to kind of to do stuff. But very early on, they realized that the internet couldn't handle that type of for scale reasons. So in order to basically kind of simultaneously encourage platforms to take down a lot of problematic content that was coming up, like spam and pornography and things like that and hate speech, they decided to grant them immunity. And it was kind of very much, by giving them this blanket immunity from defamation and stuff, it meant that they could take down as much or as little as they wanted and create their own culture and their own kind of expression themselves within these sites.
So that law now is 20-something years old. Do we need to revisit?
Yeah, I mean, we are. There are a couple of bills on the floor right now.
Yeah, but Congress can't find its own backside with both hands, right?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes you can't tell whether that's a good thing or not. there's been a lot of talk about revisiting it, about kind of creating carve-outs for bad actors that do not kind of hamstring Section 230. The nice thing about Section 230 is it's very hard to see what it would look like if you did start to introduce liability, because it just... one of the things that could happen is that platforms could start just taking everything down that looks hugely problematic. You'd have huge over-censoring, you know, just because it would be safer to take everything down than to, like, leave something up and have it, you know, have yourself get sued for it. Right. The other thing they could do is not take anything down, which would mean that we would be back in the world in which, you know, no one takes down trolls or hate speech and Alex Jones stays up, Nazis stay up, all of the things stay up. So those are kind of like the two worlds Section 230 straddles or tries to avoid.
So as a woman, just on the way out here, as a woman who thinks seriously about this stuff, and with the caveat that we're kind of winging it because we're in the middle of all this change as it's happening, now what?
There's something really amazing about the conversation about Alex Jones, because I think that it reflects that these platforms are susceptible to the pressures that users put on them. The other bad thing is that I think that it puts a lot of emphasis on kind of this outrage mechanism that seems to be the way that we react to things on the internet and in politics in general these days, that the more angrier we are, the more change we want right now, they change things. And then, like, you know, I bet you in 5 weeks no one will even remember this Alex Jones incident.
Oh, my God, that's probably true, right?
It's so true. Yeah. Like, I've been doing this for a while, and I could list seven different things that if I mentioned them, you'd remember them. But you're like, I've never been this angry about anything before. It's like, actually, kind of have. but it does. So I think that the balance of those two things, getting in place kind of a responsiveness from platforms and then, like, trying to not make it too responsive. It's very much a constitutional convention type of problem, right, that they created with what they had to to deal with early on.
And putting on my history buff hat, you know what happened in the Constitutional Convention, right? They threw the old thing out and created something entirely new.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Oh, man. And I never even went to law school. Kate Klonick, she's at St. John's University School of Law. She's a fellow up at Yale as well. Kate, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Are you cracking yourself up there?
I am. Best thing that ever happened to me was not getting into law school. I'm just saying. So look.
That's what my dad tells me all the time, too.
Absolutely right. But you know, I don't know. It's so messy. It's so messy, which honestly is a
It is. And there's no, you know, to that last point, there's no hope that these platforms are going to be thrown out and that we're going to start all over again.
Right,
so
right.
We're going to be literally trying to repair a moving train. And
that's a good analogy.
It's going to be really messy, I think. I don't even know if that's a thing, but it's going to be messy either way. But that was a great, like, that was such an interesting conversation. Yeah. I was delighted to get to listen to it after the fact and be like, oh.
Yeah, she was really good.
All right, that is it for this week's Make Me Smart. We have one more week without a new show, which means one more week of one of our favorite interviews that you get to hear again.
Yay.
Or maybe for the first time because you might be new to the show.
Oh, there's that too.
And it really is one of our favorites. It's an awesome tale tracing the origin story of some spam, the email kind, not the canned meat, although I'm sure there's a lot to learn about canned meat also.
I'm sure I said this last time we did this story, but I went to flight school in the Navy with a guy whose last name was Hormel, descended from the Hormel family of spam fame.
No way.
Yes, true story. He was, can I just tell you? Well, never mind. Never know. I can't because now that I've named him, I'm not going to. All right. Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. The senior producer is Eve Troh. Tony Wagner with a quick finger on that music, by the way, is our digital producer director again this week. That might be another strike against you, Tony. I don't know. Program was engineered by Jake Gorsker. Theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
Hey, you know who you never want to work for? Kai Rizdal, the executive director of On Demand.
Standards have to mean something.
High standards. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. They both have high standards, too.
Whew. True. Bye.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.